Welcome to the Arrangers Podcast. I'm Aaron Hedenstrom.
And I'm Drew Zaremba. The Arrangers Podcast is dedicated to the insightful discussion of music arranging and composition.
What we do takes a lot of hard work and resources. We are asking for support from listeners like you to continue to make this podcast available for everybody.
Please consider contributing a monthly donation to our Patreon platform. We sincerely appreciate any contributions you are able to give. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram, or leave a review on iTunes.
Be sure to send us your questions and feedback to thearrangerspodcast@gmail.com and find out more at www.thearrangerspodcast.com.
Let's dive in. Hello and welcome to the Arrangers Podcast. Hello, friends of the International Society of Jazz Composers and Arrangers. And hello, Aaron. How are you?
Hey, Drew. I'm doing really well. How about yourself?
Just fine. Thank you. Today's event is so miraculous that I thought it needed just a little bit of an intro. For those of you who have been following the Arrangers Podcast, you might be aware that we've been doing this as a pet project for fun, and we've gotten to interview some amazing people. It's also been a way of just staying in touch and keeping our friendship alive, and it's been something really special to both of us, hasn't it, Aaron?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
So you can imagine our surprise when we were asked by Chuck to begin a little partnership, to work together to achieve lofty goals and sharing really wonderful exclusive things to the ISJEC membership. That was a beautiful day.
Yes, and I think we were incredibly honored and excited to partner with an organization that's doing such incredible work. And I mean, obviously, Chuck and all the other people who are involved are just incredible musicians and incredible people. And yeah, it's been a real dream come true for us. And we're just really, really pleased to be able to work in such meaningful capacity.
Truly, truly, truly. And so you can imagine our delight when we were told, oh, we'd like you to make an episode about Duke Ellington and Mary Lou Williams and Chick Corea. And Aaron and I both immediately, our eyes lit up, and through conversations, we just got excited because we thought, well, Chick is still alive, right? Like, I mean, yes, of course he is. What a privilege it would be to interview him. I mean, we were like, no way is this going to happen, right? Like,
right,
there's
yeah.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that would be incredible.
It would be a dream come true. And here we are. We ask a few people to help make the call. And a couple days later, wasn't it, Aaron? Like less than a day or two later,
I think so.
We had gotten confirmation for an interview with Chick Corea.
I know. It just was awesome.
And so we without getting too far deep into this intro, we are just so delighted to share this hour of what was, for me, just beautiful and so much wisdom giving and an insight into one of the geniuses of not only piano, but of composition and arranging alive today. It was an incredible experience.
Yes, and I think what was so wonderful was that Chick was such a gentleman, and for all of his accomplishments, I mean, you know, decades and decades of prolific output as a player and as a writer and as a recording artist, I just think he couldn't have been a nicer, more humble person and so generous and willing to share his time, thoughts. And one of the coolest things was hearing him talk about his approach to teaching and his academy that he started, because I thought it gave a really nice window into the way he views the learning process and the creative process. So it was just a beautiful conversation. And then we got into some deeper questions with composition and talking about his process. And I found some really, really cool nuggets that I kind of surprised me. So that was really nice.
Yeah, no, he needs no introduction. He's Chick Corea, for crying out loud. So let's get right into it. Let's, you know, one of the foremost piano players on the world today, one of the most influential composers of all time. Here is relatively unedited our complete interview with Chick Corea. Thanks for listening.
Enjoy. All right. Thank you so much for taking the time to meet with us. It is an incredible honor.
Yeah.
Well, my pleasure. We're gonna wait a minute. Let me adjust something here.
We're gonna
talk about, what are we gonna talk about?
Oh boy, we have some fun questions, but so Aaron and I are part of the Arrangers podcast, and we're friends with Chuck Owen. And so he asked us to do a series of episodes on different composers and arrangers. And so we thought, and your name came up, and so we thought, well, what if we get to interview Chick?
Yeah. And this is for Chuck's thing?
Yeah, it's for the International Society of Jazz Composers.
Right, yeah, sure. Chuck's a great guy, man, and he's an amazing band leader and composer. He's a good friend.
He really is. And so we'd love to talk about composition, arrangements, and anything else you want to talk about, of course.
Well, okay. Are you both composers and pianists or keyboard players or
saxophone and keyboard for both of us?
Yeah. Oh, both. Yeah. I see. Mm-hmm. Equally proficient or?
For me, I would say sax is definitely my stronger instrument.
I would say so too, but I play enough B3 on gigs or whatever to make a ruckus.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I on my academy, I always, well, not always, but recently I remember giving the cheap advice to because the people that tune into my academy are all kind of different musicians from all levels, and they play all kind of different instruments. And I told them that, you know, all the really serious guys that I've worked with, bass players, drummers, horn players, whatever, they all play some piano, all of them.
Right. Oh, you have to.
Everybody plays some keyboard. So I told them, you know, play, you know, if you don't, like, get some verse with the piano. And then I had Gary Husband. Do you know who Gary Husband is?
I've heard the name. I forget who that is.
Look him up. Gary Husband is the keyboardist / drummer in John McLaughlin's Fourth Dimension, and he's an amazing musician. And we did a piece together recently. So anyway, when Gary came on the Academy as a chat, and I said, "Well, what advice do you have for the students?" He said, "Well, everyone should know some drums."
Yeah.
You know, so and I thought, you know, that's equally cool. The keyboard and the drums, that pretty well covers it.
Well, that was your upbringing, wasn't it?
Keyboard. Yeah. Well, piano was first, but drums came pretty quickly after. Actually, piano was first when I was 4 or 5 years old. My dad was a trumpet player, so when I got early in high school, I started playing some trumpet. And my St. Rose, the church that I went to, had a drum and bugle corps. So I joined that, and I learned to play the bugle. Then drums came after that. But now the instrument that is the most biggest connection between the piano and the drums for me is the marimba. I've got a marimba that I practice. I love the instrument.
Oh, cool.
That's amazing. I love it.
We were just listening to your Origin group, and I was looking up the credits and noticing that you were playing marimba on that as well, and I was pretty happy about that. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, I have this portable. See, when I was playing for many years with Gary Burton, I got intrigued by the mallets, but I enjoyed the marimba. And I asked Gary, I said, "Why don't you play marimba?" He said, "Well, it's not his thing, you know." But yeah. marimba was more my thing because of the rhythmic thing of it. It reminded me of African music. Mm. And so I used to, when I had Origin, I just for fun, I carried that portable, it's a 4-octave marimba. I carried that portable marimba with me and I set it up behind Jeff Ballard, behind the drummer.
Wow.
And I would play like, I would approach it like a percussionist. Like I'd find some phrases that were something similar to what a percussionist might do with wood blocks or, but I had, you know, the harmony going as well.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. This is just delightful. We have some specific questions, of course, but while we were preparing for this interview, we watched several of your recent videos on YouTube from the Chick Corea Academy, and we just really enjoyed what you had to say about improvisation and rhythmic feel and classical composition, and we just noticed really great quality and quantity of content. It seems like that's something you're really investing a lot of energy in right now. Would you tell us more about that and maybe some other projects you're working on right now?
You mean about the Academy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the Academy is kind of the first physical, almost physical. Well, it's online, but it's pretty physical. It's the first physical realization of my love for sharing with other musicians. Like I enjoy an environment where there's a lot of music and art being created. I mean, you guys know that as well as I do that our camaraderie with other musicians and other artists is like it's a deep camaraderie. You know, I mean, sharing that passion that we've got with each other. And I think that the more of that that occurs in a community or a city or and eventually the world, the stabler the environment becomes, the calmer it becomes, the more sane actually it becomes. Because when people are enjoying themselves creating, you tend to think more clearly, I think.
Wow.
Rather than getting embroiled in you know, whatever other things that embroil people. That's been a long-term goal. So the Academy is like the first physical realization of that. And really, it's been one huge experiment because I knew what I didn't want it to be, which was a school that had a curriculum and that had tests. The one one of my basic philosophies about sharing and encouraging someone into the art form that I'm in is to do it in a non-critical way. What I've observed in the past, that there's been an accepted way of teaching, which has got to do with the use of a lot of criticism, especially in classical training. You see a young student there with an older master, and the master and the student plays the piece for the master, and the master is telling him what to do at every moment. He said, "No, more this, less that. No, that should be more. Give it more, or however they do it."
Yeah.
And come on, man! Like we're trying to encourage creativity. We're trying to get so the Academy is based on non-critical help, encouraging others to learn how to think for themselves, basically, and learn how to create enough confidence in their own imagination and in their own way of doing things. Because you could take, you know, the master that took that, whatever the piece, you know, they're playing Schubert or some classical piece, Mozart or whatever it is. I mean, Mozart wrote, just to take as an example, as a composer, that's a good example, right, Mozart?
Of course. Oh, yeah.
Pretty competent guy there, you know, and I'd say
yes,
which you can tell his competence, not so much for me. I assess his competence not so much by the performances of others playing his music, But I'm fortunately, I'm skilled enough to look at a score that he wrote and see what he wrote myself. So it gives me a direct line to Mozart, and it kind of takes time away, because if I'm looking at these notes that he wrote down, and it's like reading a letter that he wrote, an aesthetic letter at that time, and there's no, I don't have to think, well, he wrote that in 1770, whatever. It doesn't matter, because there it is, and it exists now, and I'm looking at it, and that's what he said. And there's no editor, there's no interpretation, there's no one telling me how to interpret what he says, and there it is. So I take his, so what that approach does is it helps me become directly friends with this master myself. And that's how I've approached the great composers that I study from, is that of course I listen to renditions and I have my favorites and not, but then I'm pretty choosy about my renditions because because I know how I would like to see it performed. So the Academy is about helping others think for themselves how to share knowledge in a non-critical way, in an encouraging way. You know, when you find, if you have a young, I like to give the example of my, I think it's a good example to give. It's perfect because when my first grandchild was, I guess, just several weeks old, and I hadn't met him yet. And my son Thaddeus, who's a musician, a wonderful drummer, Thaddeus brought Aiden, my first grandson, to an electric band rehearsal, and I took Aiden in my arms and said hello, and then immediately took him over to the piano.
Yeah.
Now he's just several weeks old. He's just kind of barely sitting up. I put him on my lap in front of the piano so that he's kind of right up against the piano with my arms around him like this. Yeah. And I did nothing. I did nothing. I just sat there with him, said, Aiden, there's my piano. You like it? And he looked at it and he didn't do anything for a while. So what I did was I played a note. I went bing, bing. And without very much delay at all, he went bing. And he pressed the note down. So he figured out that made sound. So I pressed another note down. He pressed another note down. And pretty soon he was whacking at the piano, you know. Yeah. And so am I going to tell this kid at that point, hey, look, your fingering is bad. Look, I want to tell you how to get a better sound out of that now. You know what I mean? You're not doing that quite right. You know, it's ridiculous, you know. So if you take that example and you extrapolate it to, you put it into the context of an already developed young musician who's a student, and he's got certain skills and he's got certain things that he wants to learn, and he sits down and he plays for you, are you going to point out all his rough spots or what you think are his rough spots? So, right. So the way to share is first you create a safe line with the person by admiring whatever he does that's good. Hey, man, that was a nice phrase you just played. Is that your song? Wow, great. That sounds good. You know, rather than, well, you know, if you keep doing it, maybe you'll get better. I've even heard some say, some go to the extent of telling a young student, in fact, some of the greats have stories like this, that they had a teacher that told them, look, let me tell you right now, I want to keep you from having losses in the future. You just don't have it. I would look for another profession if I were you. I've heard stories like that. So that's an extreme example. Yeah. And that can destroy, even a little bit of criticism like that can destroy whatever positive goal that the young student has. So Yeah. That's a very, very basic thing of the Academy. It's a non-critical sharing. And then basically the only other thing that we can do as, which I do with the Academy, is just every time I give my opinion, I make well sure that they know it's my opinion. No rule, there's no dogma, there's no authority in this. The whole rule is that you have to learn to think for yourself. But how I worked that out was this, and this is how I think about it. Now, how you think about something is theory. So when they use this awful word, music theory, I have to remind them that that music theory is how a musician thinks about something. Whatever you think about, like if you say, "Oh, that's this chord," or you give a name to a chord, or you get a concept in your mind of the form of something, or you try to understand a book that is given to you that has words like Mixolydian in it, you know.
Yeah.
So then you have to understand that when someone says Mixolydian to you, that there's a language there. It probably has a meaning, and if you want to find out what that meaning is, you can find out what the meaning is. But immediately you have to assess how useful is this piece of information to what you want to do. So it always goes back to an artist's own goals. So in a long-winded short answer, that's...
Ooh, I'm going to start using that one, a long-winded short answer.
Yeah. That's the Academy.
Well, it sounds a phenomenal place to learn and grow. I'm curious to learn more as I check it out a little bit more. But thanks for sharing that, and for also sharing your creativity with your students and everything. I mean, that's
really beautiful.
What is a compositional process look like for you, or what is the range of processes look like for you as you're writing pieces? Because you've written so much in so many different styles. Is this something you have a process for? Is it sort of different every time? If you could just give us a little window into that.
Well, you know, every time I'm asked the question, which is basically, how do you compose? It's sort of, I come up with a different look at it, because composing music to me is so close to the idea of just living life to me, because it's become what life is for me, to the glorious part of it.
Yes.
And it also makes use of the, you could call it, tool that we've got, that if you isolate it, this nebulous thing, not so nebulous, but nebulous nonetheless, if you isolate this thing, you realize that this is almost everything positive that there is in life, which has got to do with one's imagination. The conservative level of society maybe dampens the imagination, or you know how a mother will sometimes the young child will come up with some ideas, and the mother says, you know, that's fantasy, that's not really the way it is, like this is, it'll draw something. This is a tree. No, that's not a tree. A tree looks like this. You know, that's again the critical approach. You know, right. So one's imagination is when you compose, when you do anything really. See, this is the point. When you do anything, if you do it with some aesthetic to it, rather than just do it as a drudgery, if you do it as something that you want to do, or something that's fun, or something that's pleasing to you, then you have to use your imagination.
Yeah.
You should be using your imagination. It's like the imagination equals the future. If you had no imagination, you'd just be the effect of everything that went on around you. And I have to ask somebody next to you, what do I do now? You know, wow. So your imagination is what sets goals for yourself. So that's the wide view. So on composing, I see it two ways in terms of a process. One way is that a very practical way is that I get a gig.
Yeah.
And you know, we do need to have gigs to survive. We need to exchange with the society around us and deliver something that they're willing to pay us money for.
Yes.
And pay the rent and buy the next keyboard and get my special Tombow 2B box of pencils that I love, and my special fancy pencil sharpener. I need money.
Yeah, that's right. We do.
So a gig is really a good impetus to set a goal anyway. It sets a goal and a target. Like, what do I have to do for that gig? And for me, I've always get the most pleasure out of bringing my music to a gig. So I will, like, for instance, the current example is I just put together the agreements with my longest standing band, which is the Electric Band.
We've been
going together since the mid 80s.
Right.
83 really is when the trio started. And we just put together our schedule for next year. We have a summer tour and we have a fall tour. And the guys, it's all the original band with Patitucci, Dave Weckl, Eric Marienthal, and Frank Gambale.
Yeah.
And so what I'm doing is I'm putting together a live recording that I'm producing and marketing on my own of the Electric Band performing a couple of years ago, I think 2016. Wow, it's 4 years. Anyway, it sounds pretty fresh to me. We had a week at Catalina's in LA.
Oh, nice.
And you know, when we play in a club, it's just so loose and wild and burning, and we're playing like two shows a night for six nights, and it gets greased up, if you know what I mean.
Oh yeah.
And so I'm putting together that recording. And then the idea of composing comes in here, which is I had the idea to want to put together two videos to promote the record and to begin to announce to people, yeah, the Electric Band is coming back around, here we come, you know, some promotional ideas. So these kind of videos that I'm getting used to making since the lockdown with friends long distance, and where I'm learning to do, you know, send a guide track. Everybody puts their parts down, and then when everybody puts their parts down, they put a camera to it too.
Right.
But
right.
Then we have a video, a real time performance, and Dave Weckl's going to edit it together. He's a great editor.
Wow.
Yeah, he's really good at that. Cool. So the long-winded short answer to this one is that I wrote a new piece for this purpose. And I thought the Electric Band should have some new music to play. And so I had a target now. At first I was gonna present it next year, but now I have a target to do this piece for the video. So that's what I'm working on. I'm working on that. So that's the impetus to do that. But the other way of composing, that's having a gig. That's sort of a gig. Like it's a goal. It's a target I set.
Yeah.
The other way of composing, you can never deny and should never deny, I think, my advice is, which is you just write something just because you're having fun and for no other reason. You have no gig in mind. You have no final thing in mind, and you're just kind of experimenting. And I'm experimenting all the time. In fact, last night I came across these three things that I did during the lockdown a couple of months ago, just for fun. And I thought, wow, I'm going to continue in that direction. And you know, I wrote a series of songs in the 70s, for instance, called the Children's Songs, the piano music.
Of course, yeah. And
I wrote those pieces without any goal in mind other than I need to relax from Return to Forever being on the road, and I think I'm going to take the time to just write some piano music. So it's like you can enjoy writing without having to have a reason. In fact, you can enjoy anything without having to have a reason to enjoy it. And it's actually another principle of the Academy.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
That's beautiful. I would like to know, I'm sure that it's been, what has the percentage been for you, like, of tunes that you write for, like, I'm just going to ask, because I love so many of your tunes, Chick. Windows, of course, comes to mind. It's a favorite of many jazz people. Was that for a gig, or was that for your enjoyment, or a mix, or just out of curiosity?
You know, I can't remember exactly. I do remember that the first one to record Windows, I think I may have written it for him.
Really?
Is Hubert.
Oh, okay.
Hubert Laws made a recording, one of his first records in the 60s, called The Laws of Jazz.
Mm.
And Windows was, you know, ever since meeting Hubert, I met Hubert in 1960.
Wow.
Check that out.
Yeah.
Before you were born. And he was a student at Juilliard, and I was just a new student at Juilliard in New York. And we used to sneak back in a back room because they didn't allow jam sessions in jazz. There was no jazz at Juilliard at that time.
Oh.
We used to sneak back in a back room and close the door and jam. And Hubert was amazing on that flute way back then. So it became a love of mine to as an instrumentation to piano and flute. Later on with my band Return to Forever with Rhodes and flute.
Of course.
Yeah, so I think I wrote Windows for Hubert.
Well, he recorded it with you on Inner Space, right? That's when he did it on your record, is at that point, or unless I'm mixing it up.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, Inner Space was a record that I never authorized.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The recording that I did, that all of the tracks from Inner Space came from, is a record called Is.
Oh,
and
wow.
Is was my second record. My first record was Tones for Jones Bones.
Of course.
My second record was Is, and it was with a whole bunch of guys. It's when I was experimenting with free playing.
Right.
We had Dejanette and Horace Arnold, two drummers. We had Dave Holland. We had Benny Maupin, Hubert Laws.
Yeah, right.
Woody Shaw played trumpet, and the main piece of is a long improvisation called Is.
Right.
We just got in the studio. It was inspired by Coltrane's Ascension.
Mm, and, right.
And his Coltrane's foray into free playing. But I don't think. If there was Windows on Inner Space, it came from Hubert's record. There was another piece, waltz, on that session that came from Is, called Song of the Wind.
Okay.
That is also a waltz. Maybe you could check that out.
Nice. Oh, fantastic.
Speaking of, composing tunes for other people, do you usually have people in mind when you write something, or I know maybe a mixture of approaches, but what percentage maybe do you think about writing for other people versus writing for, you know, just pure musical ideas?
Well, like I said, there's a lot of joy in just writing for writing's sake, just writing, and I do that as much as I can. But being living in a society where there's income tax and so forth, And we have to think about how to make enough money to keep going. So you tend to become, unfortunately, we tend to become oriented in that direction. So in order, so I think a lot of my, as I grew older, a lot of my compositions became project oriented. Mm-hmm. It's either for a tour or for a recording, you know. And actually the positive side of that is that when I have specific musicians to write for, and they're musicians that I love to play with, that's a real kick. Like when I write for the electric band, I've got this orchestra there sitting waiting, and I see what their abilities are and what they can do. I recently finished composing a trombone concerto for the New York Philharmonic for the principal trombonist, Joe Alessi. He's been the principal trombonist for 35 years for the orchestra, and he's an amazing musician. So he invited me to write for him, so we got to know each other. I invited him over and we played, and I got to see this amazing instrumentalist, this amazing soloist who I was gonna write for. He can play the trombone like a flute. I mean, he can do anything with the instrument. He's amazing. But then what I needed was more reality on the New York Phil. So right. So I went one of my trips to New York, I had a night off and went down to Geffen Hall and caught a concert and heard the Phil play. And then Joe introduced me to the principal percussionist, Chris Lamb, because I'm highly interested in percussion when I write.
Yeah.
So I got to know some of the musicians of the orchestra, and I heard the band, and it's an amazing orchestra. It's just an amazing, great group. So I got to see what I've got to work with, and that stays in my mind when I was writing. But there's another part to that which I think I should mention, because I have observed over the years that when I work with really extremely talented, virtuosic players, they love to be challenged.
Yeah.
So if I try to always just find out, well, what's your range? And, you know, do you ever do stuff like this? And can you double tongue or whatever? I find that it's a better approach. And what they more expect from me, actually, because they may know my music, to just let the stops out.
Yeah.
I even writing for soloists, sometimes I even ignore instrument ranges. Because what they'll do is, for instance, I learned this from Hubert when we did the record Is.
Yeah.
There's a track on that record called It, because the whole idea of that record was a three-word haiku, which is, this is it.
Okay.
That was my haiku. This is it. Meaning, here we are right now, this is it. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a piece called This, and I told you that long improvisation was called Is.
Right.
Well, I had to write a piece called It, right? Mm-hmm. So I wrote this 1 minute piece that was a piano piece, really. And then I before the date, I thought, you know, I bet Hubert this would sound amazing. Unison, just unison, is no improvisation, just a minute of written music and so I handed it to Hubert and I said, Hubert, see what you can make of this. Mm-hmm. And he took it home and rearranged the extreme octaves that were out of his range and arranged it for the piccolo. And check it out. And he said to me, he said, you know, I love to be challenged. Don't worry about range. And I've got that same comment from other great musicians. They say, don't worry about range, just write and let me figure it out. So that's another approach to knowing who you're going to write for. You know who you're going to write for, but then still don't restrict your imagination.
I remember reading some program notes for the string quartet piece you wrote, The Adventures of Hippocrates, for the Orion String Quartet, that there was some challenges there for them, rhythmically speaking. Is that, was that a similar experience or not so much? Or
yes, it was similar. I knew that they were a very fine quartet, and they commissioned me to write the piece. What came out in my writing were rhythms that many rhythms actually that came from my world,
yes,
rather than the classical world, which I knew would be interpretive wise would be maybe relatively unfamiliar for them. So I attended a couple of rehearsals before the premiere we did in Santa Fe.
Right.
And and we went through it together. And you know, I sang the rhythms and tried to explain a little bit. And when I work with string quartets, I do the awful thing of telling them how advantageous it might be playing some of these phrases if they tap their foot, which is outlawed in string sections, right? So if you tap your foot, because you know, one of the nerdy technical things I like to point out to students interested in rhythm is that when you're writing to a bar line and there's a tempo, when you have a tempo, you have a pretty regularly recurring beat happening, whatever it is.
Yes.
You know, have a beat happening. So whatever rhythms you put on top of that beat are automatically you can think of as polyrhythm, because it's two rhythms. You know, you go ding, ding, or you go boom, boom, da 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 ba 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 dum 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 ba 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 ba. You got two rhythms going on. And the doom, 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 doom is the beat, you could say.
Right.
So there's a lot of ways to break that up to have a grander beat or a shorter beat. But in the rhythms that I grew up in, the syncopation rests, only makes sense and has a swing to it when it rests on top of a beat.
Right.
And when there's nobody pounding out ding 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 ding, and all you've got is da 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 da, and you want that to, you know, you want that to, you need to kind of sit on the grand pulse.
Yes.
Da 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 ba da 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 ba. You need to kind of sit on it. There's no way around not moving your body. I mean, I think it's the silliest thing in the world to not move your body when you play, because the music is moving. How are you going to play music if the body isn't somehow moving? So when we rehearsed, I recommended that they do something like that. And I think that might have helped a little bit. But I think their rendition came out really, really nice.
Oh, it was beautiful.
Really nice, but there are some other quartets that now play that piece, and the Harlem String Quartet plays that piece, and there's a group in Europe called the Montaggi Quartet that play it, and like any of us would approach a written piece of music, you play it with the rhythm you've got built into you.
Right, it's a beautiful piece. I wasn't hip to it until just a month or two ago. There's so much material there. There's so many motifs that you build on, and everything makes so much sense together. I guess one question I come at, my imagination sometimes is limited. You know, I want to have more imagination, But where I find my some of my compositional strength is in the editing process. Like in the, maybe I'll have an idea, and but I don't know where to take it. But then I kind of start to artificially, manipulating it will help give me some inspiration, and then editing it and so far and so forth. What role does editing have in your process, like taking away things or adding things, or once you've done it, do you do much editing?
It depends, really. The more I've been out there through the years, relying on and loving to just perform and improvise, for my composing, I've relied on my ability to improvise quite a bit. So,
sure.
So and with improvisation, the idea is to approach whatever piece you're doing or whatever phrase you're doing, to approach it so that this is going to be it. You're not approaching it sort of that I'm going to throw an idea down which I'll later edit. You're approaching it like, well, this is the gig. And here we go. And I've done that so much, both in recording sessions and live, that I've kind of rely on that. And in fact, it's very difficult for me to do a better second take.
Wow.
My second takes are usually more thoughtful because I'm thinking about something.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'm good with a second take if I just throw the first take out and I say, nah, I was stumbling over everything. Let's just do it again.
Right.
It's a new piece of music. But if it's a piece of music or a form that I already know and it's a throwdown, it's got to be a first take. So the composition tends to be that way to a degree to me. So if I get an idea, I try and grab it. And the best way for me to grab it is to play it. So if I'm thinking of an idea, and I because when you're improvising, you play, and you're not, I personally don't remember everything I improvise. I remember nothing that I improvise, actually. So when you're composing, the idea is to set it down.
Right.
And if you're using musical notation, which I do, then you got to get it down. Well, how do you get it down if it's moving so quick?
Right.
So what I do, I rely on the new technology of sequencers. I've been using Logic since it came out.
Wow.
And Logic has a score page, and sometimes, you know, I have a disclavier also. So if I'm at the disclavier, I can throw that on and play the idea in, you know. But if I'm composing a piece and I know already some parameters about it, like what the tempo is, I'll tend to improvise. Like a lot of Hippocrates, a lot of those phrases and ideas were very much improvised.
Wow.
And then what I do with the improvisation is I'll go back and I'll edit some. I'll look it over and I'll go, oh yeah, what I meant to do was this. Or that, when you're playing keyboards or any instrument, you go to play an F and you hit an F and an F sharp at the same time.
Yes.
So I'll take the F sharp out. You can do that with MIDI. It's so nice, you know.
Oh yeah.
And I will do a certain amount of editing, but it's like building. When you're composing and you're not performing, you have the ability to go back and look it over and make sure it's what you want, you know. And if it isn't, you can change it. But one more is the right word, caveat. One more little detail on that statement is that I have found it mostly successful that if I'm moving a piece along, like when you're composing, it's nice to compose off of some genuine interest.
Yes.
Rather than turning it into a hack job. Like you really want to go down and write.
That's right?
This is like, this is not only fun, it's like an honor to have, or you could pat yourself on the back that you've survived well enough to pay the rent long enough that you have the time long enough to sit down and fool around.
Yeah, right.
So you can pat yourself on the back, say, I'm doing pretty good now. You know?
Yeah,
I can fool around now for a while. And but the caveat is that I would, if I'm writing a piece and it gets to even the shadow of a stuck point, like if I find it like a little bit of effort going on there, mm-hmm. or I come to an end of a phrase and you know, is what I've learned to do, and I used to not do this and go down further. Wow. What I've learned to do is do one of several things. One is get up and take a walk or get a drink or stretch.
Yes.
Get away from it for a minute. The other thing I've learned to do is have a quick look at it and think, well, no. Second thing to do is to leave that piece of work alone for now.
Huh.
Save, close, and go to something else. And so what I do in my workspace is I go back and forth between composing a composition and practicing whatever I want to practice on the piano.
Sure. So
back and forth. Now I've got a percussion rig I put together because I'm writing a percussion concerto for the Philadelphia Orchestra. So I put a percussion rig together. I go back and forth between different projects in the studio. And when I come back to the composition, I look at it freshly in a new unit of time, because that's one of the abilities we need as composers to be able to. To me, this is what concentration is. Concentration is not forcing myself to sit down and continue. That's not concentration. That's forcing yourself to sit down and continue.
Wow.
Yeah. Real concentration is when you can comfortably be with your project, comfortable and enjoying and moving along, and then just stay right there without mental distractions or the phone ringing. That's concentration. So if it gets to a stuck point where I'm not concentrated so much and I just leave it, you know. And then the third thing on that is that you may not realize it at the moment, but you could consider the option that you've finished.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's always the question. What's next?
Yeah, so. You could finish. You could say, okay, that's either that phrase is done here. I'll just cut out that long note, move back a bar. That's a good place to end that phrase. Or put an ending on the phrase. Or put an ending on the piece. You know, I found that it's not really necessary to end every song on or every piece on a high note or on some dramatic conclusion. You can peter out.
No,
wrong with that.
So one question that I have is, as you're writing, do you ever use pencil and paper? Do you ever just hit record on like a phone recorder or something like that? Or
all of that.
Variety of methods you use to kind of get
all of it. That. Yeah. I sometimes, if I'm away from the things and I've got some real cool idea going, I'll put on my voice memo and sing it in. Usually stuff like that doesn't come to anything actually, but I'm being responsible to my composing hat. But there's certain times where I'm improvising something, but then I'll come across a phrase or a way. It's a phrase that I hear that I want to do that requires me to get a pencil out. Mm. And so I'll if there's some contrapuntal stuff or there's some other voices that I want to add meticulously, I'll take some time to to with the pencil, with pencil and score paper. But I used to write everything pencil and score paper and then send it to an engraver. Now we've got Logic and Logic score page, and we've got Sibelius, both of which I know pretty well.
Fantastic. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Well, it's almost 5 here. I just want to make sure we're respecting your time. Do you have?
Let's do a wrap up because I've got an appointment coming up at 6.
So. Yeah, we have two kind of fun, easy questions, and one is what are you listening to lately? What are you checking out and absorbing?
Let's see. I saw finally the second half of Million Dollar Baby, Clint Eastwood's movie that I saw years ago.
Yeah.
When I go on Netflix and I have some time to watch something, I usually watch movies like 10 minutes at a time and then I shut it. Yeah, I can't hang the whole way through. But right. I realized in Million Dollar Baby, I never saw the ending. So I watched that recently. But what? I've been spending most of my listening time the past couple of weeks reviewing mixes for the new Electric Band Live album. So me and Bernie Kirsch, Bernie's been with me since 1975, recorded all my albums. He's an amazing artist at that. And so I'm reviewing mixes. Let's see, what else? I've been checking out on YouTube. I've been checking out and listening to the amazing pianism of Yuja Wang. Are you familiar with her as a classical pianist?
I'm afraid not.
My three favorite living classical pianists are Yuja Wang, Yevgeny Kissin, and Lang Lang.
Mm. And, wow.
And so, you know, my own makeup as a musician is, I'm known as a pianist, but really I think of myself as a composer. And you know, do you ever hear the term composer's piano? He plays composer's piano.
Of course, yeah.
That's
of course.
Me. I play composer's piano. Yuja Wang and Yevgeny Kissin and Lang Lang, they play the piano. Yeah.
Chick, I'm gonna very respectfully disagree.
It's a matter of what comes in how you think of it.
I hear you.
So I've been listening. A friend sent me a link of I've watched through the years. Glenn Gould has made a lot of great videos.
Recently. Oh yeah.
And if you want to study a great pianist, you study Glenn Gould. You study Horowitz. Those are two of my favorite older classical pianists. But the current ones are Yuja Wang, Yevgeny Kissin, and Lang Lang. I love watching them. What else? I go into the kitchen and I turn on the Symphony Channel.
Nice.
They're usually playing Beethoven or for Bach, which is okay. I recently had a piece of mind. They gave me a segment as one of the living American composers, and I got to play. My septet and my first piano concerto
another great piece. Oh my gosh, that's an amazing piece of music as well. I love
it. Let's see, anything else? That's what I've been. I come across a lot of different stuff. I have an alarm. I have different musical 45 snippets on my iPhone alarm. So when my alarm, I have different songs, you know how you can do that on an iPhone?
Yeah.
So I listened to Miles and Philly Joe Jones on Porgy and Bess.
Nice.
Oh man.
A lot, you know.
That's killing.
Vintage tastes.
Hey, that's beautiful. We both, Aaron and I both grew up as classical pianists for 10 or 12 years. So I can't wait to check out, but I haven't been in the scene, for a minute. So I'm really keen to check out these Cat's your favorite piano players. These.
Yeah, yeah. Yu Jiwang is a young Chinese lady, pianist. Evgeny Kisin, you should listen to the, check out what he did. Oh, what is it? In London, at this, they call it props. It was a props concert. You know, in London, at this huge place. It wasn't a concert hall. It was this huge gathering place, and he played like 10 encores.
Oh my gosh!
This was years ago, and and it's just one of the most amazing piano performances from beginning to end. Check it out.
I can't wait. Thank you.
All right, guys, I got to run. I enjoyed sharing some of my long-winded short ideas with you.
I love it.
It was our pleasure and really an honor. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Chick,
okay, thank guys.
You.
Good luck. Take
thank
care.
You.
If you talk to Chuck before me, tell him I say hello.
You got it.
Well.
Okay. Later.
Later.
Bye-bye. Bye.
What a treat to be able to talk to a musical visionary of such a high level, and man, what a beautiful conversation.
Yeah, I'm really inspired now. I haven't felt this inspired in a long time. I feel like he's so knowledgeable and so wise, and yet so humble and still seeking after the same things that we're both teachers and educators, Aaron, and he's saying the same thing that we were taught and the things that we are teaching. It's just very affirming and very encouraging and inspiring. I feel incredible.
Yeah. And this is the case with most musicians that you meet. It's all about giving and giving generously. And I mean, certainly we all by our mentors, and it's a good reminder that we can give our talents, give our time, give our energy and our passion to our colleagues and our students and our audiences. And it was just really cool to like talk to Chick, because he obviously embodies that on such a full level. And you know, like when you've seen so many videos of him performing and you know, the audience is just so enthralled in his music, and then you meet him, it makes perfect sense. It's like, oh yeah, like he's all about giving and he's all about sharing his creativity, which I think is just incredible.
Yes, and I think that's a perfect note to end on. Thank you so much to all of you listeners for listening. A very, very special thank you to Chuck Owen and Ischak for supporting us in what we do in our podcast, and for giving us the connection to interview someone as great as Chick Corea. That's really, really special, and we're just so happy to share it with all of you. So thank you for listening, and we look forward to producing the next episode. Thank you so much. Have a beautiful day. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Arrangers Podcast.
If you enjoyed what you just heard, you can support us directly with a small donation on Patreon or by sharing this episode with a friend.
You can hear lots of other interviews, score studies, and fun discussions at www.thearrangerspodcast.com or wherever you find podcasts.
Bye for now, and keep writing.